Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 32, recorded August 30th, 2010. IPTV comes of age. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is TWiT's own Paul Thurrott, host of the Windows Weekly podcast. Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much.
I'm sure glad to have you here. Those of you who are tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged on to the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Paul, and I'll pass as many along as I can during the show. Meanwhile,
Oh, I just agreed that that was okay. That is fine with me.
Thank you so much. Sorry. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I really like having the opportunity, providing the opportunity for listeners to ask questions of my guests, because it's a great opportunity that I hope that a lot of people take advantage of. But before we get to those, I am going to start by saying that when Paul and I talked earlier today about what we were going to talk about on the show, he came up with a great idea that I think is wonderful, which is the changing face of TV and movie delivery from over-the-air cable and satellite, the traditional forms, to IPTV, such as Netflix, Hulu, even network websites. And so, Paul, give us your overview of how this paradigm or this landscape is changing.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I feel like this year, finally, it's all starting to come together. You know, my history with this sort of stuff dates back to, you know, the early days of PC TV interactivity, and Microsoft, of course, did their Media Center stuff and so forth. And at the time, the big goal was to get network TV onto your computer, record it, you know, allow you to watch it at a later time and so forth, DVR capabilities and all that stuff. But, you know, the world has evolved. And this very week, you know, Apple could have some interesting announcements around the future of Apple TV, possibly. There are services like Netflix and Hulu and many others that are really, I think, redefining how we enjoy TV content and, you know, video content in general, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And I think the days of, you know, must-see TV Thursday night at 8 p.m. Eastern may be drawing to a close, you know. Because of Seinfeld.
Yeah, exactly. Did you have a web TV box? I remember that many years ago. I didn't have one, but...
Yeah. My parents did, actually, as well. My parents had one that was based on dial-up networking, as I recall, a very ancient...
Oh, my God. Oh, man. A
terrible, terrible experience. I mean, even previous to Media Center, actually, now that you've reminded me of it, there was, in fact, a web TV for Windows product that was part of Windows 98, maybe 98 SE, I can't recall. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, we've been working on this stuff for a long time, you know.
Yes, finally, this this sense of convergence. Leo and I were talking about this on the radio last week. You know, we've been talking about convergence for how many years? 10 years, maybe? 15?
Sure.
And
this
now,
is our version of the paperless office, you know. We'll get there.
Eventually, exactly. And yet, as you say, this year may be... Last year, maybe a little bit more, and this year even more, and next year probably more so. TV and movies also being delivered over the internet, what we call IPTV. But here's one question I have about that. You mentioned DVR capabilities and recording for later viewing, and no longer do we need to have must-see TV on Thursday night at 8 o'clock. And yet, there's the issue of digital rights management, DRM, and the difference between streaming and recording for later viewing. Right. How do you see that battle playing out?
I think there needs to be a fundamental change in the way that we think about this content. You know, currently people around the United States and around the world subscribe to cable TV services of some kind, typically, and they get a package of some kind, they get certain content. But what you're, if you think about it, what that really is for the most part is streaming capabilities or live TV. You know, what we think of as live TV is really like streaming. There are on-demand capabilities, there are DVR capabilities now built into set-top boxes and so forth. I think that what's going to change is, rather than have this lineup of shows that come on at a particular time and when you have to sit around the TV like we used to gather around fireplaces or the radio, you know, in early days, I think that the content will just be out there. Maybe it becomes available at a certain day and time, but that you subscribe to something that gives you the rights to view that. I mean, the way technology's improving these days, it seems like I should be able to be on the road, but log into some system that knows I'm a subscriber to whatever the service is, and I'll be able to access those shows from anywhere, not just from my particular TV in my house. So I think that this is really a dramatic and important change, and I think it's going to be very beneficial to people. And I always think of it as more of a super on-demand system. I should be able to sit down in front of a screen and say, you know what? I want to watch a very particular episode of a very particular show right now, and I should be able to do that. And I think that that's where it's heading, basically on demand.
It's true that the streaming, even though it's streaming, you can request it to happen at any time. It's not like it's only going to stream on Thursday at 8 p.m.
Right, right. And I think that's the difference between, even though you don't necessarily own something that you've recorded with a DVR, the goal really is watching the content you want when you want it. Right now, I think we're like, you know, collecting this stuff on our hard drives. I have to have this. You know, I have to maybe I rip a DVD to a video file, or I record a TV show with a DVR, and you sort of ferret it away so I can watch it later. You know, I think in the ubiquitous availability of the future where, of course, broadband has to be much more reliable and better performance than it is now, less expensive and so forth. But I think we're moving to a system where our concepts of ownership are going to have to go away, that what we're really going to do is essentially subscribe to something that gives us access rights.
Sure, exactly. You know, Leo often rails about the onerousness, if that's a word, of DRM. And I have to say, I agree to a certain degree if it's truly draconian to get to your stuff. On the other hand, as a content producer myself, you know, I have to say I don't want to just abandon DRM and make everything free, because then there won't be any content.
Yeah. It you know, I've written books, and it's sobering to see them show up for in free PDF format on a file sharing site or, you know, content. Well, I mean, you know, I think once you've been ripped off, you sort of appreciate DRM maybe a little more. I agree that it needs to be less onerous. And every DRM scheme I've run into, with rare exception, has caused some problem along the way. But you know, it really is a matter of, you know, content owners, content producers don't want their content out there freely available, freely stealable, I guess would be the way to say.
Exactly. Right.
There has to be some control. And there's content protection built into things that we don't even consider. DVD players and our cable TV systems are heavily DRM protected. It only becomes an issue in this kind of Wild West world that we live in with PCs and so forth, because, you know, we're used to be able to get online and share things and copy stuff, and all of a sudden we're noticing that that's not capable with this content.
Right, exactly. Now, of course, DVD DRM has been broken long ago, and there are now DVD media servers you can buy that, you know, you can rip DVDs to them and play them wherever you want. Blu-ray is also broken, for that matter, although it does have a kind of a renewable key system, so it's a little more robust. But I've always believed that there is no such thing as an unbreakable DRM. Any DRM, someone's going to break it.
I agree. But there's also, you know, and again, this is more of a maybe a simplistic moral view on my standpoint, my point. But I think that people will pay for things, for services, if it's not onerous. You know, I think that people get a little upset when they buy something digitally and now they don't have access to it. You know, you've exceeded your rights limitations and you can't open this video on this computer or whatever it might be. Things like that, are harmful and people react badly, as they should, to that kind of thing. But yeah, when DRM works, it's in the background and you don't really notice it. You know, the most annoying thing about watching a DVD isn't that there is DRM on it. It's that they put a bunch of previews on the front that you can no longer skip through. Or whatever, right? I mean, that's so maybe DRM is okay in that standpoint.
No, you're exactly right. And Disney is among the worst offenders on that. You just have preview.
Literally thinking Disney. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're insidious,
I'm not afraid
right?
to name names here.
Yeah.
Well, this brings up another thing that you and I talked about earlier today, mm-hmm. which is the Zune paradigm as opposed right. to iTunes. Take us through that a little bit, would you?
Yeah, with the understanding that everything I say is probably about to change, right? Because we're recording this on a certain day and Apple's going to have an announcement and who knows what's going to happen. But iTunes content, Apple's content on iTunes to date has mostly been about ownership, right? You can purchase movies and TV shows. You can purchase songs. You can download podcasts and other content, purchase audiobooks and iBooks and so forth. They do offer rental of movies only. And generally speaking, you download the file. There's no streaming involved at all. You can watch it as it's downloading, but essentially what you're doing is downloading a file to your computer. Under such a system, which has proven very popular with people, you are responsible as a user to keep track of that content. So if you buy a mobile application for your iPhone from Apple, you buy a TV show, a movie, whatever it might be, there is a file, and you have to keep track of that. If your hard drive goes south, yes, you can go with, you know, hat in hand back to Apple and ask, and they usually are pretty good about getting your stuff back. But you have to do it yourself. And there's something interesting going on the other side of the fence, the side of the fence that no one even knows exists, which is the Microsoft side of the fence. You know, I feel like I'm one of seven happy Zune users out there. But Microsoft has created a platform to compete with the iTunes and the iPod ecosystem that Apple has. And historically, that platform, which is called Zune, has been most famous for the devices, you know, those things that are like iPods and so forth. But over the past couple of years, they've expanded it out to be, in fact, a platform. So there's services that sit behind it. They have their own marketplace. They have an incredible and fairly unique service called Zune Pass, which is a subscription music service that allows you to access most of the, you know, 7 million plus tracks they have in their marketplace. Streaming over the web, literally to websites. You could use them on your Mac that way. Streaming to your PC using the Zune PC software. Streaming over Wi-Fi or a 3G connection to a Windows phone. Over Wi-Fi to the Zune devices and so forth. And to the Xbox 360, which of course is Microsoft's living room solution for digital media. Obviously for video games and so forth. And what's interesting about the Zune stuff is that aside from all the obvious things, you know, they have applications that will run on Windows Phone in the future. They have applications that run on Zune HD today. You know, they have music and TV shows on offer and all that stuff. If you buy anything from Zune, it will always be available as part of your account. So if you log on to your Zune account with your Xbox 360 and had previously purchased, let's say, a movie or a TV show, that content will always be available to you from any device on which you sign into, PC, Xbox 360, portable device, whatever it is.
So you never actually download the data? It just lives in the cloud and comes down to you on whatever device you log on with?
You could do either. So one thing I have done recently, in fact, I did this just to test it, and you'll have to excuse my choice of movie here. I purchased the movie Hot Tub Time Machine from... I know. I grew up in the 80s, so I have to...
All right.
It's important that I understand movies like this. So I purchased it on my PC, but I never watched it on my PC. After purchasing it, in fact, I never downloaded it. I went out to the living room and I turned on the Xbox 360. And Zune has an instant streaming feature. It's 1080p quality, 5.1 sound. And I just started it up. It saw that I had purchased the movie. I clicked on it. It came up in 1080p. And if you haven't seen it, the Zune streaming stuff is actually fairly impressive because the way they do it is they start streaming it immediately. So you can watch it, literally is instant on. It's not 1080p until about 10 seconds in. But you can see the quality actually improve in front of your eyes. And there's a little gauge in the bottom that shows you how it going up, and then the little HD light comes on and it's perfectly, you know, crystal clear and beautiful. And that movie, sadly, will always be attached to my account. I'll never be able to get rid of it. It's part of my Windows Live sign-in. You know, I'll see it anytime I install the Zune PC software, for example, a link to that movie is in my media collection. You know, anytime I log on to the Xbox 360, there it is, you know, so.
You can't get rid of that, that little indicator?
Well, you could on a device-by-device basis. So, for example, in the on the Xbox, well, actually, I'm not sure on the Xbox 360, on the Windows PC, if you go into the Zune PC software, you can actually delete the little link, and then it just, mm-hmm. it just won't show up in that place, you know, if you don't want to see it there. But it's always associated with your account, the notion being that once you've purchased the content, it's yours, and you can access it from any point. There have been systems in the past that offered something like this. You know, if you've used anything like Amazon On Demand, they actually have a very similar system where, because of rights management, they let you download it to a certain number of devices. But once you've exceeded that, what you get in the future for content that you purchased is streaming rights. And you can always stream movies or TV shows you purchase from Amazon in the same fashion, for example. Mm-hmm.
So what's the advantage of downloading and storing something then if you can get it anytime?
Well, and that's right. And that's exactly right. So we're in this weird transitional phase where I think there are a lot of people, especially probably people listening to your show, maybe who are perhaps ripping DVDs, or they've ripped their music collection, or they, you know, they're storing content. They record shows on TV with DVRs and so forth. Mm. And we're using storage locally to store this stuff, where this is perhaps more efficiently done in data centers for us, where we have this on-demand menu and we can access the content that we want, whether we own it or not. You know, I don't own any of the TV shows I watch on cable, but of course I still have access rights to them because I'm paying for my subscription. And I think the future of this and the future of the Zune stuff, perhaps through a Zune Pass that works with TV shows and movies as well as just music, is that notion of on-demand streaming, where you get some form of access rights to whatever library, and then, you know, perhaps for a monthly fee or whatever, and then you can access it from whatever compatible devices you may have.
You mentioned earlier that the image quality and the sound quality were pretty good, although it takes 10 seconds and you sort of notice an improvement, which that would bug me. But what?
Well, you could do this. So one thing you could do actually is just start it playing and pause it immediately. And then it would actually buffer, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'd prefer it if they actually buffered it for 10 seconds or so before sending it to you and saying, you know, buffering, please wait. Or you know, another 10 seconds, and then have a countdown timer or something to tell you when it's going to start. Because, I mean, ugh. But it brings up a bigger question. Well, and I'm a purist. You know, when it comes to video quality in particular, I'm a purist, and I admit that, and that's okay. But it brings up the larger question of the image and sound quality of IP streaming versus traditional delivery systems, and HD in particular. Standard def, I'm not concerned about. I really only watch HD, except if there's something available only in SD that I really want to see, then okay, I'll do it. But, you know, I have a beautiful HD TV, and I have a beautiful 5.1 surround system, and I want to get the most out of that I can. And I've always been concerned that streaming over the internet, particularly in the U.S., where typical bandwidths into the home are, you know, not certainly no more than 10 megabits and usually quite a bit less, which means that image and sound quality is not going to be that great, right?
No, that's true. Now, I don't know what you have for an internet provider. We happen to have Fios here. They have decent speeds and decent upload speeds as well as download speeds, which is one of those things that I think a lot of the cable providers don't understand is as important for these kinds of experiences. But
why is upload speed important for viewing TV and movie?
It's well, for viewing TV and movie, it's not, but for other things. In other words, one of the other things that occurs through my home internet connection is that I'm also serving media out to the outside world. And one of the things I like to do when I'm traveling is access content from, say, a home server. And that upload speed actually becomes very important in that case, because I'm the source. But yeah, you're right. And unfortunately, and as a purist, you're not probably going to like this too much, but I think that unfortunately for this coming generation of people, they've gotten very used to low quality sound through MP3 files, low quality video, thanks to YouTube and so forth. I think that for a lot of people, the sheer quality that you could get through a Blu-ray type display or just a pure HD display would be somewhat shocking to them, you know, how good it can be.
Well, and that's part of my job as a journalist in this field is to try and educate people and say, look, you can get stunning images and beautiful sound. You know, why are you settling for MP3 and standard def?
Because they don't know any better. You know, they wear earbuds and they're on, commuter trains and things like that. I mean, it's just the nature of the world we live in, I think, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. A lot of the cable TV systems we have here are heavily compressed. So even when you have a lot of HD channels, you're getting pixelization and lots of other artifacts, which is terrible. But, you know, it's funny when you do have a good HD TV and you do have a good provider and you can see high quality displays and what they look like. And you see this other stuff, it's jarring, you know.
Exactly.
When I go to an SD channel on my own system, it's like going back in time. You know, I'm surprised they don't play like circus music from the 1930s. It's kind of a background thing. It's so
you've jumped
strange.
Into your hot tub time machine.
Exactly. It's really horrible. But
yeah, it really is.
Unfortunately, I think for the mainstream, that's what TV is, which is depressing to say. But
yeah, how would you compare like the best you've seen from a streaming source versus, say, Blu-ray? I assume you've seen some Blu-ray on a good high definition TV. How would you compare them?
Yeah, I have to say, this may not be something that you would agree with, but actually, some of the Zune HD streaming stuff I've seen has been pretty close enough for hand grenades and horseshoes, as we say. It's not shabby. It's not shabby. Okay. But yes, as far as rock solid quality, it's pretty much Blu-ray, and then you move down from there, right? So it's going to be a step down, but there are occasions when we're just watching like a cable TV broadcast, a Shark Week or something on Discovery Channel or whatever it is. It's almost always sports or a nature show, but I am occasionally blown away by the quality of TV, live TV. But
are you talking, about over the air or cable or satellite?
This would be Fios, so it's essentially cable, fiber cable.
Right.
But I think the Zune HD 1080p streaming stuff is probably just below that, I guess.
Well, now you're also a little spoiled, I have to say, because Fios gives you, 15 or 20 megs down at least?
Yeah, I get 25 down.
25 down. Yeah. Jeez, that's so nice.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
But even though you have that, it isn't to say that the content providers aren't providing that. They're providing a lot less, actually, probably.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're going to still run into the same problems. Marmot in the chat room makes a comment. It's not just bandwidth, but also the caps that are being placed on this content from some of the providers. Have you run into any problem with that?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I haven't been to the one thing I don't like on iOS actually is some of the on-demand stuff. They actually do. I'm not sure how other cable systems do it, you know, Comcast or whatever, but on Fios, on-demand is actually delivered over Ethernet connection, over IP. So that the quality of Fios on-demand actually typically isn't nearly as good as the regular TV stuff, and that's a chance for them to do where you'll see a lot of SD content and a lot of the sort of artifacting and pixelization and even dropouts, you know, video dropouts that I would expect of lower quality systems. So in my own experience, that's the type of thing I've noticed, not necessarily that a particular content provider, like a channel, maybe has a low quality feed, which certainly has been the case. But I have one example. When I go out and visit friends in Seattle, there, if you watch The Daily Show or The Colbert Report or something like that on Comedy Central, their feed for that is significantly higher quality than mine. And I don't know why that is. If it's
their content provider?
Yeah, it is. Who is their content provider? I want to say it's Comcast, but I'm not positive.
So it's a cable company as opposed to Fios.
Yeah. It might just be an agreement between the, Comedy Central is owned by some conglomerate that, you know, the Star Chamber or whatever. and they might be there, you know, whatever, you know, Viacom or whatever it is.
Yeah, right.
They might just have different agreements with different cable and TV providers. I'm not sure.
Here's another question from the chat room. With all the compression games going on with cable and satellite, should we or even can we trust Blu-ray to deliver the highest resolution movies? My answer to that is absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, yeah, Blu-ray certainly,
was a little. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say Blu-ray is compressed. There is no such thing as a consumer-delivered content that isn't compressed, but right. Blu-ray is much less compressed because it has a maximum bandwidth output, I think, of close to 40 megabits.
I think that's right, yeah.
And you're not going to see that on any kind of streaming delivery or even cable or satellite delivery.
Yeah, and actually, I'm curious if you know, obviously today's HD content is a certain resolution or certain resolutions. Blu-ray probably has the bandwidth and the capacity to store movie content that is of a higher resolution than HD. And that's going to be one of the bigger issues coming up, I think. You know, what happens after HD and what the issues are around that. I think Blu-ray actually might have some legs for that sort of future as well, which is kind of interesting.
It might very well. The next resolution step that the people are now talking about is 4K, which is roughly 4096 by 2160 or something like that.
Right.
Four times the resolution of current HD.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Now, at that resolution, it's possible that a movie encoded for Blu-ray would show some artifacting and some some effects. We'll have to see. But, you know, once these displays get up to a certain size, I mean, you can imagine wanting to go to these higher resolutions. It's going to be interesting. And, of course, the shows I would have liked in the 1980s are going to look like horrible. Such a strange, you know, that they were recorded to videotape, you know, and
archived
in any elegant fashion at all. So.
Right, exactly right. sorry, we got another question here from Publius. The real interesting thing for me is the lower cost of entry into content creation business, the cost of a studio, streaming content, and so on. People could start filming their own sports and putting it online. And this is certainly something that I've been dealing with for a long time. Before my current role as a consumer electronics journalist, I was covering pro audio. And the whole concept of the big mega recording studio was dying as people were installing recording studios in their home that were capable of producing every bit as good quality audio. And now the same thing is true of video. I mean, look at us. We're essentially a TV station here.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I still think there's a future for, I don't know if it's network TV is the right phrase, but, you know, live sports is an interesting thing. And one of the ways I see that evolving is, you know, multiple camera angles, right? Possibly even multiple screens in people's homes where they could see multiple angles at a live sporting event. But also the availability of multiple soundtracks. You know, one of the aggravating things for me as a sports fan is we have great, in some cases, local sportscasters or live announcers and so forth. And every once in a while, one of my favorite teams will be on a national stage or whatever sort. And they have ESPN will come in or ABC Sports will come in and they bring in their own people. And these guys are always terrible. And I think it would be really interesting for the future to have the possibility of choosing your announcer or announcers. You know, even back when I was a kid, we used to watch Celtics broadcasts here in Boston on the TV, but we would turn the radio on to listen to the guy on the radio because he was so much better than the guys on TV. And this is sort of the future of that, if you think about it.
So I did the same thing here. If I were watching a baseball game, which I didn't do that often, but occasionally I would, and I would turn off the sound and listen to Vin Scully on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, same. And it's possible now with the capabilities we have just on PCs and so forth that there will come a generation of enthusiasts of whatever it might be, if it's sports or anything else, where you might listen to these people instead. And some of these people will become famous and rich out of just doing what they love because other people will enjoy it too. It's sort of a mystery science theater future almost, if you think about it.
Yeah, very good. Mystery Science Theater reminds me of kind of scratching, taking old records and mixing them together in new ways, being a DJ essentially.
Yeah, and actually, we already see lots of that in the video world. You know, there was a Star Wars mix-up that just won an Emmy Award, I want to say, or some I'm probably getting the award name wrong because I don't know anything about the, the awards. But there was literally someone remade Star Wars, but it was a huge group of people. And it was sort of a voting system where each, 30 second or 1 minute scene, everyone could vote on which one was the best. And they pushed them all into a version of Star Wars. And George Lucas has given his okay for this. They're going to add the official music to it. And they actually won some kind of award. And it's almost like a crowdsourced, movie brought, made from scratch. It's crazy.
Flash mob movie. That's amazing. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so who knows, where this stuff's going to go. It's really interesting.
It's very interesting and exploding fast. Here's a question from the chat room. Any idea when Blu-ray will be built into Windows Media Center PCs like DVDs are now? Aren't there some Media Center PCs with Blu-ray drives?
Yeah, there are. What we don't have, and I don't think we will have, is Blu-ray built into an Xbox 360. and it's just a licensing issue or just some, distaste from the whole Sony versus Microsoft thing. But
maybe it's blowback from the Blu-ray versus HD DVD days. My last podcast guest was Kevin Collins from Microsoft, who used to be the big HD DVD evangelist for Microsoft. Sure. And so maybe there's a bad taste in their mouth from that. And they just go, I don't want to put Blu-ray on there. Even though they could.
I think it is something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Got another question in the chat room from Ken Crayley. Who asks, what's the best way to build a home theater PC? What cases do you recommend? Now, that's getting pretty geeky, and it leads me into the next part of what I wanted to talk about, which was the nuts and bolts of a home theater PC.
Okay.
So what is your answer to that? What's the best way to build one? You could buy one that's set up for that automatically, but for those DIYer geeks out there.
I had a Media Center PC in my living room for several years, and it wasn't until, I think we talked about this earlier, it wasn't until cable card came around and Fios and HDTV and so forth, and it was during the Windows Vista time frame, it was just prohibitively expensive and hard to add those capabilities to an HP PC using Microsoft software. So since then, I've been using the standard Fios DVR stuff, which is horrible, and looking for a way around this. But one of the things I think that's changed that we were talking about earlier is just the way that we access this content is changing. And I'm wondering now, except for the very highest end home theater geeks, whether a traditional HD PC actually makes much sense anymore. In fact, one of the things I'm testing right here is it's an Acer Aspire. I want to say that this thing costs about $129, and all it really is a netbook in a little case, that you can use in your home. It would not be possible to drive a decent HTPC system off of this box. But this box would be very possible to do with, or what would be very possible to do with this box, is some of the IP streaming type stuff. And that's actually what I'm investigating, whether this thing is viable for that kind of use. It's almost too underpowered. I'm sorry. Oh, it's an Acer Aspire. It's just a teeny little netbook class PC. It's almost too underpowered to drive HD resolution video stored locally on its own hard drive. That's how underpowered it is.
Wow. But
for streaming capabilities, it might actually make some sense. So I'm looking into this right now. But, since my own foray into this, the home theater PC stuff, things have changed dramatically. You have the possibility to walk into a store, buy a cable card, add these things to your own computer and so forth. I think that this kind of PC is one of the rare instances where do your own actually makes a lot of sense, where not buying something off the shelf is actually the way to go. And if you are going to be going down that route, I think the possibilities there are fairly endless, and it's just expanded in dramatic ways. But again, it's funny. This box is less expensive than an iPod, and I bet it will make a pretty decent little streamer just for the IP type streaming stuff, Hulu and Netflix and so forth. But I'm going to be testing that this week.
Right. Does it matter one case versus another in terms of, say, RF rejection or filtering or interference shielding or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the my own system, which is a former HTPC, has amazing problems around those very areas. You know, I have to buy specially shielded audio cables because the interference is so bad.
Wow!
It's still a problem even with the shielded cables. So, yeah, I don't have like a particular case or whatever that I would recommend at this point. But I mean. Yeah, this is it's a tough area because you need to really read up on it, make sure you're getting the right stuff and so forth. Like I said, I mean, there's so many options out there now. It's amazing.
Now, do PCs, I'm a Mac guy, so I don't know that much about Windows PCs, but do Windows PCs now commonly come with HDMI outputs, or do you have to buy a card for that?
Yeah, actually, most modern PCs would have HDMI out. In fact, this little $129 box has HDMI out. Obviously, that's pretty much baseline. If you're going to put it in the living room, to me, as far as I'm concerned, HDMI is the baseline. You know, that has to be it.
Absolutely.
And you're seeing that on the Mac side. Finally, they're moving over to, at least through an adapter, right? You can get HDMI out on pretty much anything now.
Right. Yes. DVI out has been available on Macs for a long time, and that's basically audio-less HDMI. And yes. Simple adapters are very easy to get to plug that into.
Right. They're actually starting to build them into the actual Macs now, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Like the new Mac Mini probably has HDMI out on it, I would imagine.
Let's see, what else would you need? I was going to go back. This brings me back to more traditional forms of delivery, say an ATSC tuner. You'd need to stick one of those in there if you had an antenna on your roof or even in your room and you wanted to get free HDTV, which actually looks really good.
Shockingly good. If as long as the reception's good.
Yeah.
And that's an issue I've had here. So we don't have an antenna on the roof, and I've tried to position antennas around the house. I have a crazy, those triangular antennas for ATSC in my closet, right? I could only get a handful of channels this way without doing something up on the roof. But that's the final piece of the puzzle, I think. If you're looking at these IP solutions, if you think you could go Netflix and Hulu and all that stuff, the one thing you're going to miss out on is local TV and sports, specifically in my case. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you need that little glass of cold water in the form of my wife, who shows up and I'm telling her my grand plans for the living room. And she says, "What about the Red Sox?"
And that stops, I think, you dead in your tracks.
Antenna, you know, yeah, there's always a problem. So, but yes, I think people would be astonished at the quality of this thing, and it's free. It's available basically everywhere, and it's free. It's just over the air. And I don't think a lot of people know about this, but this is an incredible capability.
It's absolutely true. I get my over the air on TiVo. Mm-hmm. And it just looks great. Any over the air I've seen just looks fantastic, and so I'm sure it does the same in an HTPC as well.
Absolutely.
So, and what about cable card? Which is a little credit card size thing. You stick in a slot, and it lets you get encrypted or premium cable channels. I know that some PCs let you do that, and I don't know if it's now typically included, or if you have to again add another thing, another piece of hardware to your system for that.
So what you would need is an internal cable card, you know, one or two or more. I mean, Windows Media Center, I don't remember the latest version, but they support multiple connections of this fashion. So unlike with Windows Vista, one of the reason I got off of the Media Center stuff in Windows Vista timeframe was that you couldn't add cable card after the fact. You had to buy a pre-built system. You couldn't be a white box PC. It couldn't be something that you built yourself. You had to literally buy a machine from a tier A PC maker that had cable card built into it. And whatever it came with, if you had the one tuner or two tuners or whatever, that was it. It was never going to be expandable. And in Windows 7, it's back to the way it was with the analog cards. You can mix and match. You can do it after the fact and so forth. So most cable systems, Fios does this as well, support this. If you can have cable card in your TiVo, I'm sure has cable card. Or
yeah, it does.
You can have. Yes, you can add them to PCs in the same exact way. So it all integrates through Media Center.
What about going back earlier in time, getting into the hot tub time machine once again, to Windows XP? Was that analog only?
Yeah. So I don't remember the chronology of it, but the original version was analog tuners, and then, of course, they added over the air at a certain point. it's possible it's even there from the get-go, but I don't believe so. I think it was just analog only, and they added capacity over time. You could have multiple tuners, and you know, back in those days, when you're talking about analog TV tuners, some kind of an IR interface, you can have a remote control, and an IR blasting where you literally put something between the on top of the cable box, it would shoot a signal into it as if from its own remote. You know, you have that level of extraction, and the performance was horrible because. Mm. You know, you press a button on the remote, it would press a virtual button through the thing. The cable box would do its thing. It would change the channel. It was just slow. You know, if you've ever sat in front of a TV with the TV's remote and you can hit the channel up button, you know, up, 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 and the channel changes. You could not do this with the Media Center. But this all changes now with the cable card. Once you have this thing fully integrated, the HDPC will work just like your cable box does.
Mm. Any way to get satellite into an HDPC, a DirecTV or a dish?
Yeah, now I've never done this, and my understanding on the satellite end is that it differs according to the carrier. I think one of the two major satellite carriers, now there's only one if I'm not mistaken, too, supported a cable box style system, and those things would work with the IR blasting and all that. But that's something I just haven't looked to in a long time.
And it gets back to that kludgy factor that you were talking about earlier that we really want to avoid if we can.
I think for most people, you know, as bad as the software is on these set-top boxes, you know, it's less stuff. It's just there. It's already there anyway, and it works. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, just don't look into the alternatives. And this stuff, when you're adding stuff on top of your cable box, or you're adding stuff side by side with your cable box, I mean, it's a mess from one standpoint. But it's more stuff to think about, and more stuff to worry about, and more stuff that you have to manage. It's just a lot of complexity.
Which is okay for geeks like us.
Yes, although sometimes, you know, you rise up out of this kind of Sanford and Son environment you live in. And it's like, but, you know, I don't have an available Ethernet port anywhere in here, and yet there are not 15 devices in my office, but I have 15 cables going somewhere, and I don't know. You know, it gets into that kind of, you know, sometimes you just want to strip it all out and start over again because it's hard to figure out what the heck's going on.
Right. Marmot in the chat room asks, will there ever be a media extender to stream Apple iTunes content to the Xbox? Is that possible?
Not protected content, right? So Apple is always going to be very protective of that stuff. You know, that if you purchase a DRM encoded movie from iTunes or whatever, they're not going to allow non-Apple systems for the most part to take advantage of that stuff. Mm-hmm. There are different schemes for getting content that came from iTunes out to different non-Apple devices. So, for example, if you have an HP Media Smart Server, which is based on Windows Home Server, they wrote an add-on that creates what they call an iTunes server. And what it does is it looks out at your home network and it looks for content inside of iTunes and it pulls it in to its own little storage pool. And then it presents that as an iTunes source, so other iTunes installs in your home network can access that content as well. But it also shares it out using normal, for Microsoft, normal sharing routines, you know, normal media sharing techniques. And that stuff would, of course, work with the Xbox 360. So in this convoluted system, yes, you could purchase an album from iTunes. It would be aggregated up to the server by Windows Home Server, and then it could be shared out to the Xbox 360. But I mean, you can do it with PCs as well. It's just more of a manual process. But if you're talking about something you purchased from Apple that's not music, you pretty much are talking about iPods, Apple TV, and, you know, PCs or Macs running iTunes. I mean, those are pretty much the consumption points.
I guess Apple doesn't really have media extender boxes like the Xbox at this point, right?
The closest thing they have is the Apple TV, and it does that. You know, the Apple TV has onboard storage. You can copy stuff to it, but you can also stream. It's not an elegant solution in the sense that it's dumb technologically. You know, you have to have iTunes running on a PC in order for the Apple TV to see the content that's inside of iTunes, right? Whereas the Microsoft stuff just works off of whatever's in the storage. That's the reason HP came up with this iTunes server concept, because you couldn't guarantee that your PC would be on, let alone your iTunes would be running. So if you can aggregate this content up to the server, you don't ever have to worry about it. To the home network, it looks like iTunes is running on a PC, even though it's not really iTunes.
Okay. Well, that brings me to probably the last topic of conversation, which is media streaming. We've already been talking a little bit about that. Do you have a network streaming around your house at this point?
Yeah, we have various things going on here. You know, one of the things that, and I've tested this, tested this between continents, if you can believe this, you can actually push content from Windows 7 based Windows Media Player across the internet to anyone else. You can push content from Media Player to compatible devices around the house. We were recently in Germany, and they had a DLNA compliant HDTV, which was actually pretty sophisticated. And I could actually push content to it from my PC over the wireless network, and it would play on the HDTV pretty seamlessly. It was nice.
Wow.
It had HDMI and all that stuff, too. So we ended up just pretty much using that. But, you know, for testing purposes, I saw this thing. It came up as an, the TV came up in the list of possible devices. I thought, that's kind of interesting. And, it worked wirelessly, which was unbelievable.
But how was the quality over wireless? I mean, that's another question I have, is wireless or wired?
You wanted to make sure that you were only doing that. So literally, like, my friend opened his computer to access his email and it scrambled immediately. just him bye-bye. Accessing the network, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Which and do you do we any wireless streaming around your house or is it all wired?
Oh, yeah, we do. So let me think. I mean, there's so much going on here. It's kind of hard to even explain it. Most of my content right now is on Windows Home Server. Now, that's wired to the network, but a lot of the access points are wireless. So, for example, we have various devices in the living room, like an Xbox 360, which is wireless and can access the content on the home server, as well as, you know, the Zoom services and the Netflix service, which we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. We have WDTV a box. We have a dedicated Roku box, which has Netflix and Amazon On Demand and other services on there. We have an Apple TV. And the Apple TV is actually wired, but that's sort of random. That could also be wireless. Mm-hmm. The way we handle media streaming here at home is we have a dedicated end network that's just for media. And then the reason the Apple TV actually has the wire is that historically for us, meaning over the past couple of years, I guess, it's been kind of the go-to point for high quality video. So if I want that would come over the network. So if I want to stream like a DVD rip or some kind of a not that I purchase HD movies from iTunes, but that would be possible. Mm-hmm. And it was sitting on a PC. I would want it to be a wired connection, you know, straight on through from the PC to the router to the box. You know, so that one always had the wire. But the new Xbox 360 ships with wireless N. We have an N router, and I have to say, you know, it's worked out pretty well so far. So.
What's your
that's most of it?
Do you have a gigabit Ethernet throughout? Or
yeah,
and you really do need that, don't you, for media streaming?
Yeah, you can get away with 100, I think, but once you hit HD, if you're doing a lot of HD streaming, especially, you're going to want to go. Why you wouldn't go gigabit at this point is unclear to me. I think if you were doing any wiring of that nature, my house is kind of odd. It's not a particularly old house, but for whatever reason, the home. Home offices are on different floors above each other, and our media stuff is right next to it. So, oddly enough, for whatever reason, half of my house is wired with gigabit, and the other house is almost not wired at all. There's one wire that runs through the center, and we actually just have a wireless N access point on the end of it that extends the network to the other half of the house. But really, in the other half of the house, it's mostly people on laptops and so forth. So that's worked out okay, too.
Yeah. And I guess if someone already, I'm thinking about somebody who already has a 100 megabit Ethernet network in their house, all they'd really need to do would be to change the router, right? I mean, the cabling doesn't have to change.
Assuming the cabling was, of the sufficient quality. So, you know, I don't know of a good way to test this, but I have, this is no longer the case, but for a while, there was something causing part of my network to only run at 100 megabits. And I swapped wires out until it went away. And it was one of those things, you can see it in Windows, you can see it. You can see it on certain devices. It will actually tell you the speed of the network. And I just, this is a, it might even be 2 years ago now, but I noticed at some point it said, you know, connection speed 100 megabits. And I said, wait a minute, what? You know, I probably wasted a month, you know, figuring it out. But it might have been, I don't know if it was a kinked cable or a low quality cable. At some point, I replaced some cable and it came up as a gigabit. I said, okay, there we go.
What do you know? What do you know? One last question about media streaming on a local network. Any recommendations for NICs, network interface cards? You need one of those, obviously. And Ethernet switches were another point that I talked with Kevin Collins about, that there were certain things you need to keep in mind for those.
No, I mean, I do most of my, I'm in the process of switching server. Most of my streaming, like I said, comes off a server. The server that I have in place currently is an HP pre-made server. They make wonderful home servers. It's based on the previous, or actually the current generation of the Windows home server product. I'm in the process of replacing that with a server I built that's based on the next version of Windows home server. And there's a, I have other servers in the house as well. But one of the things you can do in Windows server, and one of the, it's one of the reasons I looked at building my own, was whether or not it would make sense to do some sort of like a dual-honed networking setup.
Dual-honed? I don't know what that means.
Like dual NICs, you know.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You could actually tunnel, if you will, over a double, you know, over two NICs, essentially. And whether that makes sense for media streaming. But the truth is, you know, and it's interesting because this previous generation machine is really low-end hardware. And I really haven't had any issues streaming over it, off of it at all. Over the single NIC over gigabit Ethernet, it's been fine. So I'm not even sure that that makes any sense. So I think the network connectivity is the big thing. If you can dedicate a box for this purpose, that's perfect. I mean, you notice this on wireless dramatically, but it's true even on wired connections. If you are using the machine to do other things, you know, that stuff's going to suffer. I mean, if you can dedicate a machine for this, I think that's the way to go.
Yeah. One final question from Virgil in the chat room. If an AVR has an Ethernet port, will a Windows Media PC play to this connection? I think the answer is if the AVR is DLNA client certified, right?
Yeah, it has, I think it's DLNA 1.2, if I'm not mistaken. And it will see it, if you will, from within Windows 7. From the media player, yeah. Mm-hmm. The interesting capability in Windows 7 with Windows Media Player is that if you think about media streaming in the home, you're typically pulling media, right, from a server. It doesn't have to be a, like literally a server, but the place where the media is stored to whatever the end is. You know, you do it from some interface. And maybe it's a set-top box or whatever it is in your living room or on your laptop or whatever. Windows Media Player and Windows 7 gives you a push capability where you can actually bring up an interface and say, you know, click on some media and say, play to, and then you choose from that menu. And that example I used from Germany with the TV, that's an example of a device you can play to. You know, the Xbox 360 is DLNA compliant, and well, you can play to the Xbox 360 as well. So if you're sitting in front of your media collection and you want to push it out to the HDTV, you can choose the device that's attached to the TV. Or if you have the TV, you know, if the TV is compliant, you could use the TV.
It's a brave new world.
Yes, it is.
and quite a confusing one, at least in this transitionary period. But I sure appreciate it, Paul, for helping to clear up some of the confusion for us. Thanks very much.
Well, and I apologize for my woefully inadequate setup here. I feel like I'm not worthy, but...
Hardly that. Thanks again to Paul Thurrott. You can hear Paul's Windows Weekly podcast right here on twit.tv. So be sure to tune in for that. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week is Labor Day, so Twit will be dark. And doggone it, Home Theater Geeks records on Mondays, so we always get the short end of the stick on all these Monday holidays, but oh well. I'll be taking it off, as will everybody else at Twit. In 2 weeks, my guest geek is scheduled to be Fred Mantagian, one of my favorite home theater geeks. He's a very entertaining fellow, so I really encourage you to tune in for that. And I'm sure looking forward to having a hoot with him. Until then, geek out.